Good morning. I'm going to talk this morning. I'm going to give a brief overview of the pathology of chalk rood, and then some background information on lysozyme, and then some results of a field trial we ran looking at the effect of lysozyme on chalk rood. So chalk rood is a disease of the larval stage of the honeybee, and it's caused by the heterothallic spore-forming fungus Ascaris apis. And the spores are transmitted to the larva during feeding, where they germinate in the hindgut. Germination preferentially optimally occurs at 30 degrees Celsius, and so we tend to see higher incidence of chalk rood in the spring or when the colony is under stress and unable to keep brood at the hive temperatures of 35 degrees Celsius. So the fungus engulfs the larva, where it eventually hardens in the cell and is removed by worker bees. There are color differences in mummies. You can see that there's white mummies as well as gray or black mummies. And the colors, this color is caused by the formation of the fruiting bodies, so it gives it that gray or black color. Chalk rood has a worldwide distribution, but currently there are no chemotherapeutic agents registered for the treatment of chalk rood. And current management practices include requeening, because we know there's variation in susceptibility to chalk rood, as well as comb replacement to reduce the level of spores in the colony. But that, of course, is somewhat expensive. Lysozyme was discovered in 1922 by Alexander Fleming when he decided to plate out some nose blowings. It's commercially extracted from egg whites, and its main known mechanism of action is against gram-positive bacteria, where it breaks down the peptidoglycan bonds in the cell wall. But it has other mechanisms that are not yet characterized, and it could be due to the fact that it's such a strong cation. And this could explain why it has action against some fungi. And currently it's used in both wine and cheese making, which makes it actually an ideal candidate for use on honeybee colonies. So of course, anything you put on a colony is going to end up in your honey. And so with lysozyme, there aren't the worries that we have with antibiotics about residues. The other great things about it, it's water soluble, it's quite stable, and it's relatively inexpensive. So we did some preliminary lab work. We found that in MIC experiments, lysozyme was able to inhibit the growth of Ascaris apis at 500 parts per million. And in some acute oral toxicity cage studies, we found that it had a really high 24LD50 of over 6,400 micrograms per bee. It's quite non-toxic. But I think what convinced us really to move into the field with this is some results based on an in vitro larval rearing assay modified from Christine Pang's works on American foulbrood. We found that even at levels of 0.75% of their diet, it was able to suppress chalk rood when the larvae were inoculated with 100 million spores. So we felt pretty confident about moving into the field. So we ran a spring efficacy trial in April of 2007. And our main objectives there were, one, to determine a therapeutic dose of lysozyme for the treatment of chalk rood, and then, two, also to assess the impacts of chalk rood on colonies in northern Alberta. So is chalk rood is going to be cost effective to treat for chalk rood? Is it having an impact? So in early April, we hived 41 kilogram package bees from New Zealand onto irradiated single brood chambers. We outfitted these brood chambers with dead bee traps and removable bottom boards to aid in the collection of mummies and dead bees. We inoculated the colonies using pollen patties. So Gilliam and Tabor in 1988 described a really effective way of artificially inoculating colonies using homogenized black and white mummies. And we administered the treatments in sucrose solution. And we did this simply because beekeepers already feed in the spring, and it was an easy way to integrate this treatment into an established management practice. We had five treatment groups, so we had eight colonies per treatment group. We had our uninoculated, untreated controls, as well as four inoculated treatment groups, where we fed them either no lysozyme or a low, medium, and high dose. And we administered the treatments at the time of inoculation over a period of 3 weeks. So to determine the most effective dose of lysozyme, we measured a number of things. So we counted the number of mummies produced daily in our bee traps and on our bottom boards, as well as weekly in the frames. We took larval and adult bee samples weekly to assess the presence of chalk rood in the colony. We also monitored adult mortality just to ensure that lysozyme wasn't increasing adult mortality at the colony level. To evaluate the impact of chalk rood on the colony, we measured population, both adult bees and unsealed and sealed brood, as well as measuring total honey production. for the season, and then in the following spring assessing winter survival. So I'm only going to present a few of the results today. The first, which I'll show, was a result not unexpected. So we have our treatment groups here on the bottom, and we looked at average daily mortality of adult bees across the summer. You can see that there's no significant difference, and this, of course, isn't surprising. We found lysozyme to be fairly non-toxic in the laboratory, was non-toxic in the colony. What is exciting and quite significant is the number of mummies produced daily between treatment groups. We look at our infected and our low-dose treatment group and see that similar high levels of mummies are produced daily, whereas in our higher treatment groups, we're seeing lower levels of mummies produced similar to our uninfected controls. So we're getting good suppression of chalk brood. What's interesting is if you look at this over the entire season, and I have here the average weekly number of mummies collected, starting at the beginning of May until the end of August. And what's interesting is you can see that there's that initial spike in mummy production post-inoculation, and that our infected and our low-dose treatment group continue to produce high levels of mummies throughout the summer, whereas our two higher doses suppress mummy production until about mid-July, where our intermediate dose breaks down. You can see there's a peak there at mid-July. But our highest dose is continuing to suppress mummy production throughout the summer at levels similar to our uninfected controls. So we're getting good suppression of mummy production, but is it going to be cost-effective to treat? So if we take a look at honey production among treatment groups, we don't see any significant differences. And I mean, we do see increases in honey yield, and I'll make a point here. I put this data in pounds simply because even in Canada we talk about the price of honey per pound. And the other thing to note, we have an average overall in this apiary of 250 pounds per colony. The Peace Country region is one of the highest yield regions in the world, so we produce quite a lot of honey. So I think this figure is telling us two things. One, there's other factors in impacting honey production in these colonies. And two, it appears that lysozyme may be having other beneficial effects other than mummy suppression. And if we take a look at this closer, so if we take a look at total mummy count, the relationship between total mummy count and net honey yield, we see some interesting things. So I think the first thing we see is that colonies producing similar levels of mummies, there's quite a lot of variation in production. And two, that there is variation among treatment groups. So something we didn't measure in this study is hygienic behavior. We do know colonies respond differently to infection. That's something we didn't measure. So that, there could be other reasons why colonies were producing low amounts of honey. But overall, there is a significant negative relationship with disease severity. And I think this makes sense. 5,000 mummies means 5,000 less workers. So there are some conclusions that we can make from this experiment. And one, that lysozyme does not increase adult bee mortality in the colony. Two, lysozyme is effectively suppressing mummy production. And three, that honey production does decrease with increased mummy production. And so I think it's safe to say that lysozyme has great potential as an efficacious, inexpensive, non-toxic compound for colonies. Thank you. And I'd like to also thank, I should acknowledge everyone here, I'd like to thank the people who funded this research, as well as the bee crew, who without them, such a large-scale experiment would not have been able to have been done. So thank you very much.
How likely are the honey producers in the region to accept your findings and maybe do something to improve their overall outlook?
So this is a practical question about whether not beekeepers would adopt the use of lysozyme in their own operations. I think it's safe to say there's quite a bit of interest in using this, and I think, you know, 40 pounds, although not statistically significant, an average of 40 pounds per more colony is quite economically significant, especially if you have a commercial operation of 5,000 colonies. And at a price of less than 50 cents a colony, the fact that they can just dump it into the syrup that they're already feeding in the spring. It's sort of as easy as possible for them to do this. And also, I think, easy for them to not mess it up. It's a fairly safe compound to put on a colony. So if they decide to use it illegally, like sometimes they are apt to do, there's less consequences, possibly. Any? Oh, yeah, sure.
So when you say it's illegal, what does it take to make it legal?
We
buy it if we want to treat our colonies for chopped
wood? It has to be registered, right? So you go through the registration process, which can be lengthy and expensive. The thing lysozyme has going for it, it's already used in cheese and wine, and it has GRAS status. So it's a food-grade antimicrobial. So hopefully that should make jumping through the hoops easier. But it's quite a bit of work to do that. Are there any other questions? Do you have time? Sure.
Chopped wood is also impacted a lot by environment.
Mm-hmm.
The particular year that you were doing your research, was it wet or
Oh, I can't show you. I think in the apiary, initially you can see stands of water, and so of course it's environmental, of course, and it was a cold year. And we were actually quite surprised when they did this. When Gilliam and Tabor did this, they had complete clear up in susceptible colonies after 3 weeks, and we sort of thought we would have to inoculate again. We continued to see chalk brood all throughout the summer, so environment does have a lot to do with it.
Thank you.
Thank you.